Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Judges chapter 17, which is the story of Micah and the Levite, Micah and his idol. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we finished up the story of Samson, the last judge, and now we begin in the last five chapters of the book of Judges to take up the appendices, the so-called appendices of Judges, stories which probably took place before the times of the other 12 judges, although the timing is very difficult and hard to determine. So we start now in Judges chapter 17, 1 through 3. There was a man from the hill country of Ephraim named Micah. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver taken from you, and that I heard you utter a curse about, here I have the silver with me. I took it, so now I return it to you." Then his mother said, "My son, you are blessed by the Lord." He returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, "I personally consecrate the silver to the Lord for my son's benefit to make a carved image overlaid with silver." Now, just a little heads up here. This story, this whole chapter is a prelude to the next chapter in which we see bad stuff happening to Micah and the Levite he's getting ready to hire. And so that's really the purpose of this chapter, is to show how ungodly the Israelites were in the time of Judges, how they had fallen so far from the time of Joshua when they followed the Lord. Now, when did this story of Micah and his mother and Micah's idol, when did it take place? It's placed in the scripture after the death of Samson, and some have thought because of that it happened after Samson's time, but Gill says no, it happened long before his time, before any judges, because Gill likes to quote these scriptures, such as Judges 17:6, every man did what was right in his own eyes, and in those days there was no king in Israel. Judges 19:1, now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel. Judges 21, in those days there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that word for king, by the way, can be ruler. I've checked this out in the lexicon in another context. And so I'm going to read you a quote from a commentary here later on that says that king can be leader or judge. In those days, there was no judge in Israel. So let's assume this is before all the other judges took off. The timing does not really matter that much. Now, as a literary composition note, John Gill says, in order to answer the question, why were earlier events placed at the end of the book? Here's what Gill said. Well, let me just summarize what he says. He says that 1,100 pieces of silver were given by the Philistines to Delilah to betray Samson and thus ruin the religion of the Danites. And now we're going to see 1,100 pieces of silver ruin the religion amongst the Ephraimites. A little tie there. Of course, it just could be a coincidence. I don't know, but that's what Gill says. He also says that the story of Micah of the hill country of Ephraim was the first destroyer of religion, and the story of Samuel, which comes next in 1 Kings, that's the story of the first reformer of religion who also lived in the hill country of Ephraim. Well, I think those are slim reeds to tie it together. I will just say that the appendices happened. We know not when. It doesn't matter. Adam Clark says, quote, it is extremely difficult to fix the chronology of this and the following transactions. Some think them to be here in their natural order. Others that they happened in the time of Joshua or immediately after the ancients who outlived Joshua. That's what Gill thinks. Now, this mother seems to have a widow because she had a son who was old enough to become a priest. Some people say she was very old, but she was an old widow. And she had cursed whoever had taken her money. Could you imagine? You're old, relying on that money in your old age, and all of a sudden it's gone. Somebody stole it, so she cursed whoever stole it, and oh my goodness, it was her own son that stole it. And when she did this curse, she probably also made an oath to make an idol of silver if she ever got the silver back. Oh God, if you will return the silver to me, I will make an idol to you. Now again, she was worshiping Yahweh. She wasn't worshiping Baal or Astarte or anybody like that, but still she was worshiping with a silver idol, kind of like the northern tribes in the time of the kings later on after Saul, David, and Samson, when the kingdom split and the northern tribes worshiped Yahweh under the form of golden bulls, golden calf worship. Right God, wrong method. In my opinion, it's just about as bad. Now, the son probably heard that curse. In fact, it's not no probably about it. He told his mother, "I heard you utter that curse," and that curse probably encouraged him to return the silver. Oh my gosh, my own mother's cursing me. I better give the silver back. Now, the mother had an interesting reaction to the return of her silver. She said, "My son, you are blessed by the Lord. You are blessed by Yahweh." She goes from cursing him to blessing him. Now, what does this tell you about mothers? Some mothers can think their sons can do no wrong. I remember when I was principal of a Christian school, I was instructed by the people who trained us. They said, deal with the fathers as much as you can, because mothers, they don't think their kids have done anything wrong, and your student may have brought a switchblade to school, blew firecrackers up at the fire on the grounds, used racial epithets against a minority student, or whatever. But oh, my son would never do that. Talks incessantly, fights on the school ground. My son would never do that. Well, I guess she's like most mothers. She says, okay, son, you stole from me. I'm not going to complain about that. Let's just make an idol to God, to the Lord. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that's Yahweh. And she, like many Old Testament characters, took the holy name of Yahweh quite casually, in my humble opinion. She did dedicate the idol to the Lord and not to pagan idols, as I mentioned earlier. Here's what Jameson Fawcett and Brown say about that. Micah and his mother were sincere in their intention to honor God, but their faith was blended with a sad amount of ignorance and delusion. The divisive course they pursued, as well as the will worship they practiced, subjected the perpetrators to the penalty of death. We'll see about the penalty of these idolaters later on in the next chapter. They pursued a divisive course because they separated those who wanted to worship God legally, where the tabernacle was, which was at Shiloh, north of here. Well, we don't know exactly where in the hill country of Ephraim Micah and his mother were, but close by. And here they are starting another worship. I mean, they're going to end up with an idol. They're going to end up with a priest. They're going to end up with an ephod. They're going to end up with household idols, teraphim. Jameson Fawcett and Brown calls their worship will worship. I like that word. They worship according to their own will, the way they want to, and not the way God wanted them to. Now, this idol, there's a translation problem here because the NASB has two idols, a carved image and a molten image. Carved meaning a block of wood or stone that was plated over with silver and then graven or carved on the silver. A molten image is you make a mold and pour melted silver into the mold, and the whole idol is silver. So then they would have a graven or carved image and a molten image, two images. But I don't think that's true. I think the Holman Christian Study Bible translation is better. Holman Christian Study Bible says that the woman wanted to make a carved image overlaid with silver. In other words, just a graven image. That will handle the problem. A lot of people say, well, how is there not enough silver? Later it's going to be 200 shekels of silver she's going to give to the silversmith. How can you make a molten idol out of 200 shekels of silver? You probably cannot. So I think the Holman Christian Study Bible is the best translation here. A graven image where you just have to coat the wood or the stone with a layer of silver. So we're going to assume one idol. Micah was probably quite willing to help his mother out. It must have been rough to hear his own mother cursing him. So he's not going to stop his mother. He's going to give her the silver and say, go to it, Mom. Little translation here. The NASB and the KJV have a phrase at the very end of this, I will return them to you. I don't know what that means. It doesn't make any sense to me. The Holman Christian Study Bible leaves that phrase off, so we're going to go with the easier translation. We go now to Judges 17, verses 4 through 6. So he, that's Micah, returned the silver to his mother, and she took 5 pounds, the NASB translates it as 200 pieces, of silver, and gave it to a silversmith. He made it into a carved image overlaid with silver. And let me just stop right here. This is the Holman Christian Study Bible, which translates the idol here all the way through this story as a carved image overlaid with silver. One idol. And it was in Micah's house. This man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, sometimes translated as teraphim, ephod, household idols, and installed one of his sons to be his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did whatever he wanted. Sounds like America. We don't have a king. We don't have a president either, really. I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to get political, but I will say this. The wheels are turning, but there ain't no hamster in the wheel. Now, this 5 pounds of silver, 200 pieces of silver, is not much to make two statues, if the NASB translation is right, but even one statue is not really enough to make one statue. Well, there's several reasons for this. I've already given you one. It was just a layer of silver laid over the wood or stone substructure. But it also could be she was stingy towards her idol. She had originally vowed to spend it all on the idol. Now she says, nah, I think I'll keep 900 pieces and give 200 pieces to the idol. Or it could be The 200 were spent on the idol, and then the other 900 were spent on the ephod, the teraphim, and other implements of worship, which means the implements would be worth more than the idol. I doubt that. It could be that the 200 shekels of silver was the labor fee, not materials, but the labor fee paid to the silversmith. Notice she gave the money to the silversmith in verse 4, and the rest was used on the materials for the idols. That would answer the problem of how small the idols would be if they only cost 200 shekels, if one idol cost 200 shekels. Now notice in verse 6 that common refrain throughout the book of Judges, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what he wanted. That was an editorial comment added by the author of Judges. And by the way, if you recall, we don't know who the author of Judges is. Some people say Samuel, whoever. That editorial comment was added to reflect upon Micah's unlawful activity. There was no king in Israel. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes, including Micah, who made an illegal idol in order to worship Jehovah. Now, I told you I'd mention a commentator who said that king can also mean judge. Here's Adam Clark. The word for king is, quote, sometimes taken for a supreme governor, judge, magistrate, or ruler of any kind. Now, in another context, I looked that up, and I was surprised to see that. I think it was in Revelation, trying to understand a deep, dark verse in Revelation, and king just didn't work. And I looked it up in the lexicon and said, hot dog, it can mean ruler, not just king. Well, if Clark is right that it is no ruler, that there is no ruler in Israel, that would tend to make Gill right when he says that these appendices, this story of Micah and his silver idol, this happened before all the other 12 judges showed up. We go down to Judges 17, verses 7 through 10. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there, staying in Bethlehem. Then the man departed from the city from Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim to the house of Micah. Micah said to him, where do you come from? And he said to him, I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to stay wherever I may find a place. Micah then said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. So the Levite went in. First problem, verse 7. This young man is in Judah as of the family of Judah, but he's also a Levite. How can a Levite be of the family of Judah? I mean, there are two different clans. You've got the tribe of Judah and you've got the tribe of Levi. A couple of options to solve that. The Levite might have a mother who was from Judah, and the mother married into the tribe of Levi. And so since the descent was always reckoned from the father's side, the man was a Levite from his father's side, but he was of the family of Judah because his mother was from Judah. Well, that's one way to solve it. I think a better way to solve it is this. When it says he was of the family of Judah, it means that he lived amongst the tribe of Judah, because Bethlehem is in Judah. Levites were scattered in cities all over the place, and he was a Levite who was living in the tribe of Judah. Clark and Gill suggest that as a possible answer, and I think that makes sense. So this Levite, in verse 8, departed from Bethlehem, which is about 4 miles south of Jerusalem. And then, of course, the hill country of Ephraim is even north of Jerusalem, because right north of Jerusalem is Benjamin. You go through Benjamin and you get to Ephraim, somewhere in Ephraim. He left, probably, this Levite did, because there was no law in the land, which means there was no place for him to serve the tabernacle, because people weren't serving the tabernacle, which was up at Shiloh in Ephraim at this point. So he goes north, and he comes upon Micah. Now, did that just happen randomly? Maybe so. It could be that the Levite heard that Micah was wealthy and looking for support. He's got 1,100 pieces of silver. I don't know how much wealth that is, but he might have heard that there was some money up there and the Levite's looking for the main chance. He might have had some religious reasons. He heard that there was a new form of worship going on in Micah's house, and he's a Levite, and Levites are devoted to serving in temples, right? In the temple, which hadn't been built yet, but in the tabernacle. Well, he couldn't do that, so by golly, maybe he can serve in Micah's house and go off into this false temple worship. Now, Micah asked the Levite to be a father to him. Now, what Micah was asking the Levite to be was to be a spiritual father, as John Gill puts it, a father to instruct him in the knowledge of divine things. So prophets were called fathers and their disciples their sons. That seemed to be the custom. So as prophets, as Levites, as priests. Now, of course, Micah already had a son as a priest. Now he's got I guess you could call him a high priest, this Levite from Bethlehem. He was offered a very good annual wage, 10 pieces of silver a year, plus his room and board, it says. As Adam Clark points out, it was a good annual wage. Then the NIV footnote here says it was 4 ounces and 10 grams of silver, which doesn't sound like a lot to me, but I don't know. Room and board, you've got no other opportunities. A suit of clothes, that means his priestly clothes, I'm sure. Not necessarily, but probably. And your maintenance, the scripture says. Maintenance means room and board. So the Levite went in. We go now to Judges 17, 11 through 13, and we'll finish up this short chapter. The Levite agreed to live with the man, that's Micah, and the young man became to him like one of his sons, and the young man Micah became to the Levite from Bethlehem like one of the Levite's sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Now notice this spiritual father is called a young man. So we're not talking about chronological age here. We're talking about spiritual father. He became Micah's priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as priest." Now when Micah consecrated the Levite in verse 12, he was committing a grossly illegal act, of course, because only the tribe members of the family of Levi could be priest. It nowhere, Levites could only serve in the tabernacle. They couldn't be priest. And verse 12 says, the young man, the Levite from Bethlehem, became Micah's priest. Not Levite now, priest. So that's illegal. It was a very daring and illegal thing. The whole chapel was illegal. Levites had no right to be a priest. Now, Micah didn't worry about it being illegal. He was happy. He said, now I know the Lord will prosper me. Now, that sounds sort of superstitious, does it not? Well, I've got my magic talisman in my house now, and good things are going to happen. I'm going to be successful in whatever I do. There's religious man behaving religiously, behaving superstitiously. Now, was Micah blameworthy for this? I would have thought that was obvious. But not so Adam Clark. Here's what Clark says. Now, this is interesting. This is a one-off opinion by Adam Clark. Quote, Micah was perfectly disinterested. They put themselves to considerable expense to erect this place of worship and to maintain at their own proper charges a priest to officiate there. And without this, the place in all probability would have been destitute of the worship and knowledge of the true God. His, Micah's, sincerity, disinterestedness, and attachment to the worship of the God of his fathers are farther seen in the joy which he expressed on finding a Levite who might legally officiate in his house. It is true he had not a divine warrant for what he did. Of course he didn't. It was totally illegal. But the state of the land, the profligacy of his countrymen, his distance from Shiloh, where the legal worship was, all of that considered, he appears to deserve more praise than blame. Though of the latter he has received a most liberal share from every quarter. Yeah, I'm going to give some condemnation of Micah's actions in just a minute. This blame of Micah proceeds from that often noticed propensity in man to take everything which concerns the character of another by the worst handle. It cannot be considered any particular crime should these notes be found at any time leaning to the other side. In other words, Clark is worried that somebody's going to call him a criminal because he sticks up for Micah. Well, I won't call Clark a criminal. I will say that this is the most dumb opinion. And I've read Adam Clark from Genesis to Revelation, folks. I have read more of Adam Clark than ever you will ever think about doing. And I know this man. He is an Arminian. And every time that some kind of illegal, unjust something comes up, he tries to rationalize what the sinner did and act like the sin wasn't as bad as it was. Now, he's not a heretic. He's a good guy. He's a good man. And I'm not about to say that all Arminians do this. You can make that judgment if you want to. But I know Adam Clark does. He just cannot say that the Almighty Holy God judges thoroughly and completely and intensively. He just can't do it. And here's an example of that. No, this was not good. The Bible doesn't say one way or the other, but I think you just use your common sense. Micah did what was illegal, and illegal is bad. In fact, the whole purpose of this in the next chapter is to show how blameworthy Israel was for all their idolatry. Not trying to show them, well, you know, they did it wrongly, but they were worshiping Yahweh. Well, yeah, there's a lot of churches here in America that are worshiping Jesus, and by golly, the way they do it is enough to make you want to be a Buddhist. Let me read you a more mainstream criticism of Micah. This is from Joseph Benson, the commentator, 19th century commentator. Quote, so blind and grossly partial he, Micah was in his judgment to think that one right circumstance would answer for all his substantial errors. That right circumstance, of course, was he was worshiping Yahweh and not a pagan god. Is that going to answer for all his substantial errors, Benson says, in making and worshiping images against God's express command and worshiping God in a forbidden place by a priest illegally appointed? He persuades himself, says Calmet, a contemporary commentator with Benson. He persuades himself that the people seeing his chapel served by a man of the family of Levi will come thither with great confidence, and that this concourse, together with the offerings to be brought, will procure him considerable gain. It is evidently this gain which he here calls the blessing of God. I will prosper in all that I do. He's looking for money, folks. How just a representation is this of those superstitiously covetous person who would connect religion with the love of riches. Now, this was written in the 1800s. I mean, Benson hasn't even seen Kenneth Copeland yet, or Joel Osteen, or Creflo Dollar. He hasn't even seen those guys yet, but apparently there were those types back then, too. It happens all the time. Superstitiously covetous persons who would connect religion with the love of riches, and who, as St. Paul expresses it, fancy that piety should serve as a means of enriching themselves. Gain as a means of godliness, I think is how the King James put that. So, we see here, Micah did a bad thing, and that will set us up for the next chapter, which I will entitle Danites Take the Levite and the Idol. They're going to lose, the Ephraimites, Micah. He's going to lose his idol, he's going to lose his Levite in the next chapter. He's not going to prosper. I hope you stay tuned for that. That's in Judges chapter 18, and I hope you enjoyed this study of Judges chapter 17. See you next time.